Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen talk radio show. My guest this morning is Gemini Adams. She is a multi-award-winning author and a grief expert. In her new book, Your Legacy of Love, Gemini explains, our real wealth lies not in our financial assets, but in our emotional assets. She and I will be discussing her triple award-winning book, Your Legacy of Love, to help all of us realize this amazing gift. Good morning, Gemini. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
Good morning, Johnny. I'm doing fantastic. Thank you. Great to be here.
I'm so glad to have you on. Congratulations on your incredible book. I really enjoyed reading it. It gave me a tremendous opportunity to kind of reflect back on the memories that I have with my dad and also with the four moms that had passed on. Let us start off by having you give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Did you say this is only an hour? Do you have another 5 hours?
We have all the time in the world.
Okay. Johnny, I was born in England, hence the accent, in a teeny tiny little village that had less than 1,000 people in it. So I was very lucky to grow up in what I now realize was an incredibly natural environment, very sort of removed from the hubbub of the world. And I had a very wonderful relationship with my mother and father. My mother stayed at home and really looked after us. And it's funny, your great book, From My Mama's Kitchen, I really learned to cook through osmosis by just spending lots of time with my mother. And I have such wonderful memories of sort of, you know, hanging off her apron strings, mm-hmm. head in the mixing bowl, trying to get at the chocolate cake that she was making. I went to university in Birmingham in England and studied business studies and hospitality management. And I always say I went to Birmingham for my sins because it's a very different part of the country to where I grew up. It was very interesting culturally. And from during my time at university was when my mother was diagnosed with cancer and got sick. And it was pretty tough being, you know, 200 miles away from home. And by that point, my parents were divorced as well. And so I felt an incredible responsibility as the eldest child to be there for her. So often I was driving back to from Birmingham to Salisbury, where I was living at the time, or my parents were living, to go and take care of her. From there, I really spent the rest of my 20s, I think, trying to find myself, quite honestly, losing a parent, and in effect losing two parents. My father left when I was 8, really set me up to open a spiritual pathway into my life. And so during my 20s, I was studying everything from Buddhism to Tantra on the side, while actually doing an awful lot of voluntary work. I went to China, to Africa, to Poland, to all sorts of places, really doing projects that were either aid work or something to that effect. And it was really a sort of, a personal quest that I was on to find a solid base, having had the foundations of my life really sort of dissolve around me. And then I spent a few years in London, which was, I always say, I had a love-hate relationship with the city, working primarily in marketing and production. And then finally, 6 years ago, it had always been my dream really to be in America ever since I was really young, and I had been doing research for this book, and at the time I was referring to the book as I was writing a book about death. And one day I actually realized that it wasn't really a book about death at all, although it is in principle, but really the whole book was about love. It was about preserving love. It was about making sure that you live love during your lifetime, doing things that you love, but using the metaphor of death to help people understand that. And I found this organization, somebody told me about this organization, which is the Winston Churchill Fellowship, and that, you know, you could apply to do research in any area with this organization, which was great because I'd been sitting behind my desk pondering away, thinking, I'd love to do more research into love, but who on earth is going to fund research into love? It's not something that we value really in our society, you know, other than the sort of the Hollywood variety. Mm-hmm. But a miracle occurred. I made an application to the Winston Churchill Trust, and they awarded me a fellowship. They awarded me grant money to do research, and my plan was to come and research here in the United States. And I visited about 15 different organizations, from hospices to some of the leading hospitals, interviewing their directors about the role of love in palliative care. So again, I was exploring how love is applied in end-of-life care, so people who are, you know, typically have some kind of long-term disease. And it was one of the most fascinating things I've done in my life. And having traipsed around America, I visited 15 different cities, and I even went down to Peru. I kind of found myself here, and so here I am, living in Los Angeles, enjoying the sun very much, and the wonderful yoga community here, and the conscious community, and the personal development community, and you know, doing my work and continuing to write and helping people with their experiences of loss.
Now, in your book, you mentioned something about it hit you tremendously when your mom died, obviously, and the fact that you were sort of kept in the dark for a while. And, of course, you were at a very young, impressionable age that you enjoyed. You wanted to discover the world, and only to be in a situation where now your whole world is turned upside down. What were you going through in the sense that, as were you running away, so to speak?
I don't think I was running away. I think when you, no matter what age, when you lose someone, it transforms who you are. Because, as you rightly just said, it turns your world upside down. And everything that you knew and everything that gave you certainty has been taken away. It's evolved. And as a result of that, you start to see things differently. And you actually become... Grief never leaves you. Grief is not something that we can... You know, our whole society is around, sort of orientated around fixing things. Grief is not something you can fix. It's something that you live with once it's occurred, and it becomes a part of your being. And as a result of that, you grow as a person. And I think that when, especially when you experience the first major loss in your life, you know, it's slightly different when your grandparents die or you lose a pet for the first time when you're a child. But as you know, moving into adulthood, if you lose a very close friend or, you know, your husband or a child or your mother or your father, those are your primary relationships. And it opens up an opportunity for personal growth and very much for spiritual growth too, because you start to question, I mean, everybody has a question of what happens when we die, but you don't really think about it in the context until you lose someone. You don't really, my belief is that you don't start to truly fully live your life until you have accepted death. Because once you accept that death is a possibility and a reality, it forces a different type of motivation in you, because you just realize, you really deeply realize that you have no idea how long you have on this earth, and you better damn well be living your life to the fullest, because it could get wiped out from underneath your feet at any moment. And I know lots of people say that, but I don't think you really fully understand that until you've lost someone and you've seen how fragile life really is. And at that point, you can, you know, I mean, that's why I really lived my life fully. I mean, people were sort of saying, well, you're going to Africa, and you know, you're, I mean, I lived there for 3 months. We were living in the outback. We were sleeping out under the stars with, you know, zebra literally in our bedroom, as it were, and monkeys and all sorts of things. It really propelled me into a place of, I'm not going to follow some pre-designated path. I'm going to go out and explore and find out what I really enjoy and what I love, and find out who I am. And comparatively, my peers were all sort of, you know, trying to get graduate jobs somewhere, trying to down. And, you know, I don't know that they were necessarily truly living their lives. They were, some of them, I think, not all of them, doing what was expected of them. And if you have any sense of the fact that your life may not end, may end, anytime soon, you stop doing what's expected of you and you start doing what's right for you.
Very true indeed. I mean, that's living in the moment. I remember my late singing Savannah mom telling me that always live my life today like there's no tomorrow, but at the same time, always prepare to live for another day.
Absolutely.
But she always say, always live today to the fullest extent that you can. And that makes a big difference. And then on a personal note, losing my dad at an early age too, and most recently, something that really sort of tipped the scale for me was when I lost a good friend, tragically, to a serial killer. This was several years back, but then she was so young, she was only around 28, and I've seen her the week before, and I was away on business. I came back, and only to find out that she had died. And so that changes the dynamics a little bit, I think, because then you start thinking, wow, you're right. No telling whether you're going to live to be 100, or maybe just the next day. And you're very, very right. So you change your entire perspective about life. And so that's a big difference. And I agree with you on that. What inspired you to be a grief expert?
Can I just touch on something
sure.
you said a minute?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Benny, it's really interesting. It's one of the things I touched on in the early part of the book. The mm-hmm. fact our society as a whole, because we are getting older, if that makes sense, you know, mm-hmm. the expectancy mm-hmm. used for a man used to be, you know, 30-something, you know, back in the sort of 1700s. And now you're talking about sort of 75, 80. And there are all of these prophecies that you read in the newspapers and you know, online, saying that because of technology advancements, that actually the sort of the younger generations now will be living into, you know, the 120s, 150s.
Mm-hmm.
And so that presents to many of us a slightly false reality mm-hmm. because a large percentage of the population will indeed live to a ripe old age, as they say. You know, similarly, I think it's, you know, one in three women now get cancer. There are plenty of things out there which you know, threaten our survival. Mm-hmm. And, you know, without being morbid about it, I think that we have a genuine responsibility, especially if we have children. And that responsibility is just as you know, you would take a first aid kit on a, you know, camping trip or a, you know, some kind of adventure.
Mm-hmm.
We have a responsibility to really look at the fact that if for some reason we weren't here or, you know, we were taken ill, what could we do to really provide for our children in that instance? Because, you know, in any given moment, every parent is 100% committed to providing for their children in the here and now. But it's a real necessity to look at how you can, what I call, you know, parent by proxy, which mm-hmm. means providing your children if you weren't here, continue expressing your love in some way, and really give them that gift. And so I think even though one can hope deep down, of course, that you're going to be here for, you know, your centenary birthday. it's really taking, you know, it's really being an adult and taking true responsibility if you also look at the other possibility. And what that does is it actually gives you this wonderful sense of peace of mind. And it makes things extremely clear. So if something does happen, there isn't this sort of horrible mess and extra level of grief that can go on through there not being this gift, there not being guidance and memories been captured and stories captured and most importantly, of course, the words I love you captured. And so it's really, again, about balance. It's about taking care of the tomorrow, but mm-hmm. also living for today. And I think that's going to be the motto for this conversation.
Well, you answered the question right there because of your own personal life that you've lived and the experience that you've encountered. I think mm-hmm. it speaks for itself as an expert. And one of the things, in all actuality, with my own personal things that I've encountered over the years, and one of the things that I recently shared with my older sister and her children, my mom, she's 82, and she lives in Malaysia with my sister. And one of the things I mentioned to my sister is that in today's world, we have so many gadgets that we have that we can preserve all those wonderful moments that we don't realize
mm-hmm,
that we
absolutely.
Have as compared to several years ago. We have videos that we can shoot from a very inexpensive camera, for example, recordings that we can do. So it's quite in line with what you just mentioned about preserving things that one of these days when we look back, what if I should have, could have, would have.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
It's just wonderful that what you mentioned in the book, and you give everyone an opportunity to have a how-to, to ask yourself a question, because one of the words that everybody is in denial of is the big D word that you had mentioned, when am I going to die? It's not so much how am I going to die, but when am I going to die? And I have to be the first one to tell you too. I mean, I don't even think about that, or do not want to think about that maybe till maybe the last 7 years or so. Not necessarily that I'm thinking about I'm going to be dying tomorrow or next day or, you know, the next 100 years or so. But the point is being comfortable enough to address the issue ourselves, whether you're single or even married or having children, because I think we ourselves have to be open in the sense that, okay, what are we wanting to leave behind for anyone? And I think that's where you come in with all the wonderful things that you've done in your book. Your book's broken down into three separate parts, and the first one is realize. And you talk about several interesting things, and what I'd like for you to do is to kind of elaborate a little bit more about the opportunity.
Sure. Well, I think just to start, why I wrote the book, I mean, having lost my mother, I very quickly, after she passed on, in the immediate months after you've lost somebody, there is usually a huge amount of support from family and friends. And as you're going through this sort of shock, really, because you cannot even remotely begin to understand how much your world gets turned upside down. And even though my mother had cancer, so we'd been losing her for a long time, when anybody has any kind of degenerative disease, in the grief community, they call it anticipatory grief. So I don't call it anticipatory, because to me it is part of it is just grief. I mean, you're already grieving because, you know, that person in their illness has usually retreated somewhat from the way that they used to live before. You might find that you don't do as many activities, you don't go on holidays, you don't have as many people over to the house. And so their life is transforming, and with it, so is yours. And you're already, and you are anticipating what might happen if they die and when they die, but you can't, your brain cannot compute what that's really going to be like. And so even though, you know, I called it limbo land, we were sort of stuck in limbo land for 2.5 years, because that was the duration that mum was alive but was, you know, experiencing ongoing treatments and different, the cancer developed into different areas, and each new phase would bring about a different kind of experience for the family. When the death occurred, I mean, there is, in those kind of scenarios, obviously some sense of relief, because the person's in pain and you want them to be out of pain inevitably. And then, as the reality of the loss starts to sink in, you begin to see just how much this is going to affect your life. It affects your security, your financial position. It affects your special events. It affects this person's your friend. You don't have that friendship. And as a parent, you know, they're also your in my case, you know, maternal guide. This is a source of for you. And what really happens is that, very specifically, what I refer to as the firsts in the book are major events that take place in your life. So it can be anything from an anniversary, a special birthday, the first time you go for a job interview. You know, you get pregnant as a woman, or you have your first child, or you get married or engaged, or, you know, or you get dumped for the first time. All of these things that are, they're life transforming events, but they're big events. It's not just the everyday. When somebody isn't there anymore who has been your primary source of love and your guide, those events become twice as difficult, or bring up memories and pain from the past. And so a large part of the book is really about doing things, providing guidance, capturing guidance in a, you know, a book or in a on video, as you just mentioned, or providing a special gift for one of those days in the future when you know perhaps that there's going to be a 21st birthday or somebody's wedding. Items that will carry with them an essence of your caring, your love, and really help support your loved ones when you're not there. And this is really the opportunity we have. We have the opportunity to continue to express our love beyond the grave. I did a piece of research for the book. You know, it was my realization very early on that inheriting my mother's house and car and a little bit of money were great. I mean, they really gave us a sort of, you know, temporary sense of financial security.
Mm-hmm.
But none of those things did anything to heal the pain, that the deep void that was in my heart at the loss of my mother's love. And my definition of grief is that really grief is the loss of love in our lives. And, you know, we sometimes try and fill that with unhealthy things. Other times we go out and we establish new relationships, and that helps to ease the sense of loss. But what I knew I really wanted more than anything else was that ongoing connection with my mother. And I wanted to still know that she loved me, and I wanted something that recorded that point specifically. And so I did a little survey, and I asked the question, if one of your parents died, what would you prefer, to inherit their wealth or a letter that said how much they loved you? And over 90% of the people that I questioned really wished for the letter over anything else. I think there was one woman who said it would depend, you know, Chateau in the south of France, I'd take. Most people, really interestingly to me, you know, I kind of wondered if this was just me and I was, you know, that was the way I was built, mm-hmm. which is why I did the survey, because I really wanted to know for sure whether I was, you know, a lone breed or if this was something that was shared by the masses. Mm-hmm. And it was really interesting to me to find out that really the majority of people, what is so important to them is ongoing love.
Mm-hmm.
And so the rest of the book is really about understanding that we have this opportunity while we're alive to capture our love in some way. And a lot of people might think, well, I tell them I love them all the time. You know, we do all these great things together. Of course they're going to have these memories. But it's just not the same. When somebody dies, those memories fade over time. And unless you have these words written down, or you have them captured where you're speaking them on video, or even, you know, said through a love song that's recorded and passed on a CD or something, it's hard when that person's no longer there to still feel their love, to still feel connected, to still remember the part that they played in your life. Because, you know, my mother died 15 years ago, and the memories that I have, some are strong and mm-hmm. some are, you know, dissolving with time. And so this is really vital, again, especially for parents who have young children. But it's also wonderful for couples. I've worked with, you know, elderly couples who know they're going to lose a partner. Mm-hmm. And being able to capture a message that they can keep is something that really, really helps them also cope with the idea of their loss too, because it can become this wonderful project where you can direct your energy into doing something which is really providing, honestly, the ultimate gift.
It is by design. That's something that you think about way ahead of time. And there are many things that when you recommend is basically recording the time shared, that sometimes we take it for granted that we'll have another day like that.
Absolutely. Well, you know, our entire society is focused around sharing our financial assets, which means
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
typically you go and you visit a lawyer, or in England a solicitor, mm-hmm. or your financial advisor recommends you write a will. And mm-hmm. Most of the time that will takes care of your financial assets, your property, your company, your cars, whatever it might be. Some people now are obviously writing a living will, which takes care of what they want for their own physical being in you know, any kind of care scenario.
Mm-hmm.
But mind, the bit that people are currently missing out in this end-of-life planning is the capturing and distribution of their emotional assets. And unless you're looking at those as well, it's an incomplete picture, because as I said earlier, the finances are wonderful for providing immediate security, but not emotional security. And everybody will know that with children, what they really need is emotional security, and also elderly people and anybody who has any sort of, you know, mental health issues as well. These are really, really important elements. And so the whole book is really, as you said, a how-to guide of understanding, A, what your emotional assets are, which are really your voice, your image, your stories, your ancestry, the history that has made your life and your family's life, which is obviously inevitably a really valuable part of your children and possibly your husband or wife as well, and why they've come to be who they are today. And it's also your love. And by understanding what those five things are and how you can record them in some way so that when you're not here, your family and your loved ones can at their own choice dip back in and connect with you and the essence of you and find out what their history is and find out more of who you are as a person, it's just such a wonderful gift. And you know, it's especially important. I mean, if you know, somebody has an illness and is leaving behind young children, you know, the opportunity for you to still tell them the stories about who you were as a person and who their ancestors were, who their grandparents were, and you know, continue that lineage is a really wonderful thing. But otherwise, sadly, if you don't do that, then, you know, when you pass on, all of that knowledge and those wonderful emotional assets go along with you.
I have a friend of mine who is working on a book, and this is very, very interesting. This is several years ago when I met her, and she said, what I'm going to do for my kids is that I'm going to write a book about my legacy, your inheritance. I was teasing her about it. I said, that's very interesting. I hope that your kids will enjoy that. What you're saying is very, very true in terms of what are we actually leaving behind besides money. And she obviously had money, but she's leaving something else in addition to that. She's leaving an actual legacy in terms of stories and everything else for her children and grandchildren. And that's what you just mentioned in terms of that wonderful gift of something that sometimes we all don't realize we need it. We may not need it now, but there will come a point in time where we want to be able to pop in that CD or that album or whatever that is, and being able to see something of value to us, which is actually far more valuable than the actual monies that was left behind. Very, very true.
The money usually gets spent.
The problem is that in today's society, we are geared towards the material things.
Absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm. The emotional assets hold even more value because they are, you know, they live in your heart. Mm-hmm. They keep you connected to somebody who's played an enormous role in your life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you just pointed out something really important, which is even if you don't have children, this is a wonderful thing for grandparents to do. So that, you know, when they pass on, they may think, well, my adult children don't care. You know, they've heard all my stories before. But your grandchildren may not have heard those things. And it's a wonderful, you know, gift as well to pass on to grandchildren, even nephews and nieces, if you're an auntie or an uncle. And it's kind of becomes, you know, my vision is that these wonderful legacies could become, you know, part of the family collection, as it were, and be passed mm-hmm. on from generation to generation. So in one respect, you're almost, you know, encapsulating a little part of you to propel forward into the future. And, mm-hmm. You know, we all love to sit and look through old photo albums and but so often there you see the pictures, but you have no idea who these people are. Some of the time, they, you know, their names can't even be remembered. And, you know, just imagine how, you know, more interesting it would be if you had stories about these people and you know, a little journal that they'd written which told you who they were as a person mm-hmm. and more importantly what they'd been through, because one of the things I think that we've lost the art of in our society to some degree is the art of storytelling. People would have sat mm-hmm. round, you know, years ago around a fire and shared stories through which we learn, we get advice, we grow. And those of us who are a little older and wiser have such fantastic knowledge that can be passed on to the younger generations mm-hmm. to save, you know, huge amounts of stress and sweat and tears and money by helping them to avoid the mistakes that we've made. And, you know, just passing on your life lessons, for example, even just a short document that says, hey, here are the 10 things I've learned during my life. Follow these yourself, save yourself a lot of bother. That can mm-hmm. be a wonderful, you know, hand down to a you know, a niece or a nephew or even a child.
It's very interesting. I remember years ago when I was growing up in Malaysia, my mom never wanted to tell my sister and I, not that our family has plenty of money or anything like that, but there was a thing going on to whereby the parents never wanted to tell the kids about what sort of financial situation they're in, because the kids would be fighting over what was the most important thing you had mentioned just now? Money. Mm-hmm. And the kids would be fighting over that. And of course, there are true stories about here the dad is not even dead yet. And the kids are squabbling over who's going to get what. It's amazing. Of course, society, I think, in some ways have changed and in some ways has not. So that's why I brought up the idea of here it takes two to make this happen. Have you encountered a situation in your research about that side of the equation?
Well, yes, I have, actually. There was a great radio program the other week on KCRW with a girl who'd been left letters by her mother, letters of love, as I would refer to them. Only her mother had really written almost a prescription for what she would like her daughter to be doing in her life. Mm-hmm. In this instance, it was with specific regard to the type of man she should be marrying, the kind of religion that he should be from. And really, that becomes more like emotional blackmail from beyond the grave.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, parents like to think they know what's best for their children. Mm-hmm. That's okay while you're alive, but it can be really damaging, honestly, to write a sort of, you know, manual telling them how you think they should be living their lives and leave that behind, because that's not really a gift. So it's a ball and chain. And
right.
Well, this girl had really valued the guidance she got from her mother on many things. She'd loved the fact that she had been able to stay connected to her mother's love and had in these letters her mother's, you know, love captured and spelt out. But the downside was that she had also, you know, been quite dictatorial in these letters. And she'd written one for her wedding day, and which is a wonderful idea. It's one of the things I talk about in the book.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, she wasn't marrying a man who was from the same religion as her. She'd chosen differently. And she didn't open the letter because she felt she didn't want to be upset by mm-hmm. what her mother had to say, and the fact that she knew she wasn't fulfilling her mother's wishes. And I think we have to take responsibility when we're going about creating, you know, legacy creation exercises, in the sense that it's important to share our love. It's not important, but it's not helpful if we share our opinions. That
mm-hmm.
those kept with us. Because it becomes a burden, actually, and, you know, it's not fair to leave behind that kind of legacy. You want your legacy to be about love. You want it to be about, you know, expressing the heartfelt issues, not what we think in our heads. So one piece of advice I have is, if you're sitting down to, you know, follow any of the advice in the book and doing any of the legacy creation exercises, make sure you turn your brain off and you turn your heart on to full volume when you're in the process.
Very, very true, even though your book is fairly new. But you have been actually involved with this grieving process and helping people and doing your research. Tell us some of the wonderful, successful stories that you have encountered.
There's one that I write about in the book, which I always found just wonderful. That's why it made its way into the book, which was a gentleman who had never met his father. His father died in the Second World War, and he was 3 years old at the time. The gentleman, and so he had no idea who his father was. But his father, in the trenches, had written a letter to his, which he had handed to his brother, who was this child's uncle. And when he had returned from service, he'd carried the letter with him. And it was such a wonderful, simple letter, but really just said, you know, I'm not there. I may not be there anymore. If this letter reaches you, I'm no longer here. I want you to know that I'm so proud of you, my son. I believe in you wholeheartedly. Now that I'm not there, I really need you to take care of my wife, and I think he had a daughter as well.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a long letter. It was, you know, a page and a half, very simple. But this man had carried that letter around in his inside jacket pocket his entire life. He had taken it out and read it every single day. And I saw him light up when he talked about this, and that's the power of a few words of love. What could have been a child who was left with a really damaged sense of self-esteem and loss long-term because of the fact that his father had not ever been able to connect with him in a sense of expressing his love. Instead, this was a soul, this was a man who had a sense of feeling complete, of feeling loved because of that letter. So that's to me the power of it. I mean, it's not complicated. It's such a simple thing to do, and it can really transform someone's life and take them from a place where grief can evolve into a really damaging experience if it's not, if somebody really goes into an area of what's called sort of danger grief, and can play havoc with somebody's long-term mental health. And by expressing love, we can really help to heal that and to really help to curb the sort of the level of grief that somebody experiences. And so we are, this is why this is, to me, it's the ultimate gift. It just keeps on giving. Mm-hmm. And so recently I spoke to someone who the mother had recorded a video message for the wedding day. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, the whole room was in tears. Mm-hmm. But again, tears of love, not tears of sorrow. And that's the difference. I think people might be scared of doing these things because they might think, oh, it's going to be too painful for them to watch. And more often than not, it is for the first few months because, you know, when you lose somebody, you know, you see their hairbrush and it makes you burst into tears because the sense of loss is so raw. Mm-hmm. But as time goes on and the years pass, you move from a place of pushing away anything that has any recollection of them because it's too painful, to wanting to access any little fragment, any memory, any smell, anything that reminds you of that person. And so, you know, everybody has a natural timeline to their own healing. But eventually, your loved one will thank you from the bottom of their hearts that you took the time to provide something like this. And that's what I've seen time and time again in the instances where somebody has provided a legacy of love. In the scenarios where that hasn't happened, especially where there's been conflict, situations where for some reason parent-child fell out and they haven't talked for 10 years, it's incredibly damaging. Mm-hmm. And that's somewhere where a legacy of love, writing a letter or some capturing an emotional, one of your emotional assets in any way, shape or form, can provide an antidote to the pain that can otherwise go on for somebody's entire lifetime. So this is, it's really important stuff.
Very true. One of the things that when I encountered when my dad passed on, I was here in the United States going to college, and my mom did not really tell me about what had happened until after the fact, after the funeral and everything else, because she did not want me to come home to Malaysia because it would have caused a tremendous amount of financial burden in all actuality, and she felt like, I don't need all those pain to go with it. And so in my mind, for a long time there, my dad was still alive because I was never there to see him being buried and everything else. And when I got home 15 years later, because of circumstance, it's just one of those stories that it's a story within the story itself. But having said that, when I got home, I was able to visit his grave and really have a closure. And one of the things that my mom gave me was my dad's wallet, a leather wallet that my dad had always used for a very long time. And in that wallet, it has monies that my grandmother and grandfather had given to my dad as a good luck thing, good luck charm. And now it's handed down to me. And so I have this old wallet that I carry around. It's rather bulky, but I loved it. And I have something in it from my grandfather and grandmother, all the way from my father, obviously, to me. And the irony of it, because back then we were all living in Malaysia, the wallet is actually made of 100% leather, and it came from made in USA. And now, of course, in the United States, you can't buy anything made in USA.
Hey, that's all made in Asia.
Yeah, you know? So it was really, really interesting what I have, something that, to me, that's just priceless, and I hope to one day pass it on to the next generation.
Thank you for sharing that, because that's something I want to add, actually. You know, I talk about emotional assets being, you know, an expression of you, your humanness, your soul. But there are personal possessions like that which hold incredible value to someone, and they're usually the things that are in essence meaningless, right? It's not the money and the houses and the cars and the yachts and the businesses that make our hearts sing. It's the little things that for some reason we're so anchored to, good memories, that they hold such a positive association between us and that person. And, you know, it can be something like a wallet or even a shoe or a scarf. Or there was one gentleman actually in my book whose father gifted him his football scarf because they, you know, they went to football games together and for the son. He said it was the most valuable, wonderful thing he could ever have done because it was a connection to all of these brilliant weekends they'd had together at football games. There was another lady who, her mother, she said she wanted her mother's apron because they had so, you know, so much fun together cooking family meals. And so I think it's really worth asking your loved ones, what would you like me to leave you? Rather than presuming that they're, you know, that the financial assets are what's important. Obviously, from a legal perspective, they have to be taken into consideration and, you know, divvied up fairly and in a way that hopefully will not result in any squabbling. But, you know, as I said, money gets spent. Money doesn't really mean anything to us. I mean, it's helpful for a period of time. It might ease a bit of stress, you know, financial stress temporarily, or give us some long-term security or retirement fund. But what makes the heart sing is the words, I love you, I'm proud of you, I believe in you, I'm still here holding your hand even though you can't see me. And those funny little eccentric things that we have attached meaning to and some kind of still provide some relationship to our loved one who's no longer here in physical form.
Very much so. I'm glad that my mom saved that. And another thing that I have of my dad, which is very interesting, is it's an old balancing weighing machine that they no longer make, and this was pretty much an antique that I have, and it is something very special for me because it symbolizes that's how my dad, you know, he worked all his life, and that's how he supported us. And so that's something of tremendous value to me, his passion for the family and the things that he's gone through in his life because he grew up during the war, World War II, that is. And so being in that kind of situation, and I'm actually adopted, my sister was also adopted from a different family, and coming from a culture that values legacy to be handed down for generations, that's just tremendous for me personally.
That's lovely that you have that. It's funny how meaningful certain objects that in other people's eyes might be meaningless can actually be. And as you're explaining, there is a certain symbology that's attached to that. You have an association with what that means to you and what it represents, and that's the value. It's not the actual object itself. It's the fact that it has a representation in your mind, and that's what, you know, keeps you connected to your father's principles and his values, which were family. And that's in essence the continuing bond that is able to stay present as a result of the object that, you know, you have, that the scales and the fact that they're antique makes it even better.
Right. And you brought something very, very important up earlier. I had the opportunity to be in a situation where there were a lot of storytelling in Malaysia. And simply because, I guess, at that time, not as developed as the Western culture developed. But we had the opportunity to be having lunch and dinners together growing up. And that's when our parents talk to us, tell us stories about the family, about genealogy, learning their lineage over the years. And those are wonderful history lessons that are not captured, or you can't capture it in any other way except being told in a wonderful story. So those seems to be gone now, but I think we can recreate that in so many ways by instilling it in terms of being mindful and bringing that family value back and making time. We can create that. We can create that wonderful time.
It's funny. You don't really care about your family's history until you lose somebody. And
that's
then
right.
Suddenly it becomes the most important thing in the world. And, you know, if you're sitting down with children, a lot of the time they're like, oh, I don't care. I want to go and watch TV. I want to go and play on my phone. They're so not interested in these things.
Right.
But I guarantee, I don't make guarantees very often, but later in life, you know, once you've passed on, they will suddenly have an incredible curiosity about who they are, who their parents were, who their parents' parents were, and why they came to be who they are today. And they will want that information. So you just have to trust that, you know, if you're going about capturing your life story to pass on and in that your own heritage, that somewhere down the line there will be a very welcome recipient who will want to read it.
And you're right in terms of mentioning the fact that maybe your immediate children may not be interested, but your grandchildren may be very curious in finding out about their grandparents.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I am, aren't you?
Very much so. I would have loved to being able to travel back in time. Not necessarily put up with all the so-called amenities of different centuries, but then in some ways just being able to travel back in time and meet these wonderful people because they're part of my life.
Yeah, it's a wonderful concept to be able to do that. Back reversed.
Very much so. You talk about the models of grief, and I thought that was very interesting because obviously from your research, you got some data here to tell us sometimes that we don't ourselves become conscious about the fact that we're going through a period of times of grief and so forth. Can you elaborate a little bit more about that, please?
I can, yeah. Actually, my next book that I'm working on at the moment is called You've Lost the Love of Your Life, Now What? And it deals entirely with this subject. I touch on it briefly in this book just to give people who are looking at creating their legacy an understanding of what grief is and what somebody will be experiencing and why the legacy is so valuable in helping to counteract some of those effects. And in the book, I present the model, which is called the 3 R's, the model of response to grief, which is, you know, from my experience, personal and professional, grief is something which is unique to every individual and to every loss, whether the loss is the loss of a pet, a person, or a place. And my experience is that the level of grief that we experience depends on the degree to which we were, our connection was with either of those three things. And so it can kind of be measured in that sense. If you are, you know, the person who is your primary source of love dies, you're going to go into major grief. If a distant cousin dies, you're going to be sad, you're going to feel bad for the family, but you're not going to go through the same level of kind of total emotional and spiritual fallout.
Mm-hmm.
And the model that the whole grief community has been operating under really for the past sort of 30, 40 years was provided by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who is a wonderful woman who really helped to draw phenomenal attention to the subject of grief in Western medicine, where previously it wasn't really even looked at. I mean, grief and the grieving process was really left to the ministers of our religions, and it was dealt with by our priests. But that model, which is the 5 stages, is prescriptive. And I think a lot of people get stuck with it because they think, oh, I've got to go through these 5 things, you know, anger, bargaining, denial, depression. Grief doesn't work that way. It's not a process. Grief is an experience. And as I said earlier, it's something that we evolve through, we heal from, but at the same time, grief never goes away. I saw something the other day, and, you know, it made me cry. I felt sad for a few moments about the fact that my mom wasn't here. She died 15 years ago. Grief just doesn't go away. It stays with you and it stays in your heart. The sense of loss gets easier. The fact that they're not in your life eventually gets replaced by other things. But if you loved that person, your connection with them remains for eternity. And so in the model that I have here, which has three phases, really, I talk about the reaction period, mm-hmm. and then the reflection phase, and then the recovery period. My suggestion is that whole timeline can be anything from 1 to 10 years, and really just list, provide in there the kind of key feelings, emotions, and sensations that you go through, which may happen in any order, sometimes within a space of 5 minutes, sometimes within a space of 5 days. I mean, the one thing that, you know, I can really confirm is that grief is an emotional roller coaster ride, and you know, it takes you to the lowest of lows, and all of a sudden you can be having a moment of what feels like a complete high, but is actually just a moment of normality. And it's something which we grow from, and you know, I'm really opposed to people, you know, sort of medicating themselves through grief, because it's a spiritual evolution that takes place, and actually, if you're medicated through that, then you can't get the wisdom that is being presented to you, and it's hard to see the silver lining. You know, there is. It's hard for people to see it when they first lost someone, but in every loss, there is some kind of silver lining. There is something that comes out of it that is a wonderful, wonderful gift. There is some realization. For me, my mother dying was the doorway for me to be able to heal my relationship with my father, who I'd been somewhat estranged from in the fact that my parents were divorced and I hadn't really had a relationship with him since he was living with us. Mm-hmm. Even though we'd visited every other weekend, we didn't have a close relationship. And mm-hmm. we now have a fantastic relationship. And I believe that would never have happened if my mother was still alive, because there was no need for me to develop a relationship with him. I had everything I needed, really, from my mother. But it's extremely difficult for somebody to see that when they've just lost the person they care about. So that's... and hence why my next book is really dealing with that subject and helping people to understand what their grief is and how to cope with it and how what the path of healing looks like and what to look out for.
Very interesting, and that's very, very true. I think it never goes away, because there are going to be events in your life that will always remind you of mm-hmm. certain things, experiences, the sensation, basically, like you were talking about. And I think that's just part of being human. That's just natural, and there's nothing wrong with it. I don't think you want to go out there and think that there's something wrong with you. It's not at all. Well, how can someone buy your book, get more information about you, and keeping up with your latest happenings?
Well, I have a website which has hundreds of links and resources on it for anybody who's looking at creating a legacy. There's articles, recommended books, recommended films to watch, all sorts of things. And that website is realizethegift.com. And you can also buy my book from there. It's also available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. It's available on Kindle. It's available in most of the bookstores as well. So if you just type in my name into Google or the book title, you will be sure to find it somewhere.
Very good. And what are your plans for the remainder of the year?
I'm working on my next book, so that's going to keep me busy for a while. Very excited. I'm going off to Australia at the end of the year with my brother and my sister-in-law and their newly born baby, which is going to be a wonderful end to this fantastic year.
Fantastic. We're coming close to the end of the show, so do you have a recipe for living you would like to share with our listeners this morning?
I do, really. I think that it's important to take a little bit of time every day to really be in your heart and live love now rather than, you know, waiting till the end of your life because you're too busy working and you're too busy doing all these things. It's really important that the legacy of love isn't something you just do to pass on. It's something you create by your actions in the everyday. And you're... legacy will be magnified if the love that you've shown while you're here has been fully expressed. And that's, by all accounts, from my experience again, a phenomenal thing, because I think when we get to the end of our lives and you're, you know, really on your deathbed, the thing that is going to cause you the most emotional and spiritual pain is realizing that you didn't love when you had the chance to.
Very true. Jim and I, thank you very much for that great recipe for living and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us this morning. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be T.J. Wisners, the founder and president of the CPO Institute and several other companies. He is a very successful speaker, coach, and an entrepreneur with over 30 years of experience in training executives, small business owners, and CEOs. TJ and I will be discussing his recipe to overcoming the fear of public speaking. For additional information about this show, future shows, and for my recipes for living, please go to FromMyMamasKitchen.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Twitter/FFMK Talk Radio. Thank you for listening. Have a great week. Jim and I, thank you again and have a great day.
Thank you, Johnny. My pleasure.
Bye-bye.